Mark chapter 12. Used to psalm studies, but I'm going to step apart from that here tonight. So during the Pharisee study that we had a little while back, one of the accounts I had mentioned was about the widow and the two widows' mites, and had a few different people actually asking me about that, and so wanted to go ahead and look at that here tonight. I had it on my mind and started looking into it, and so that's what we're going to look at tonight, and I'll just call this message Two Mites. And we're here in Mark chapter 12, so we'll be looking at verses 38 to 44. So Mark chapter 12, beginning with verse number 38. And he said unto them in his doctrine, Beware of the scribes, which love to go in long clothing, and love salutations in the marketplaces, and the chief seats in the synagogues, and the uppermost rooms at feasts, which devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers. These shall receive greater damnation. And Jesus sat over against the treasury and beheld how people cast money into the treasury. And many that were rich cast in much. And there came a certain poor widow, and she threw in two mites, which make a farthing. And he called unto him his disciples, and saith unto them, Verily I say unto you, that this poor widow hath cast in more than all they which have cast into the treasury. For all they did cast in of their abundance, but she of her want did cast in all that she had, even all her living. So the last large section of Mark's gospel is chapters 11 to 16. We looked actually at the previous section in a series on discipleship. And this is the last large section of Mark's gospel as a book. And this section gives the culmination and the climax of Jesus' life and ministry on the earth. Now, chapters 11 to 13, are primarily the build-up to his crucifixion and resurrection, which occurs in chapters 14 to 16. So we could divide this section into two large parts. So the first part would be chapters 11 to 13. And in chapters 11 to 13, Jesus is in and around Jerusalem. He spends some days at the temple and some nights at the Mount of Olives over east from the Temple Mount. And the second part would be chapters 14 to 16. And these chapters narrate his anointing for his burial, which occurs in Bethany by Mary, the sister of Lazarus, the Last Supper in Jerusalem, the betrayal by Judas and his arrest, the Jewish and the Roman trials, his crucifixion, his burial, and his resurrection. And that's the end of Mark's gospel. All right, so the passage that we're looking at is in the first part of this section. This is the buildup. Jesus is in Jerusalem. We went from chapters 8 through the end of chapter 10. All this time, Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem. He'd ended his ministry in Galilee, and he's on his way toward Jerusalem, which he predicted his death once he got there. So now Jesus is in Jerusalem here in chapters 11 to 13, and this is the buildup to this arrest and crucifixion that happens. So I want us to just look quickly at the flow of these chapters to understand the context of this particular passage. All right, so chapter 11 actually begins with Jesus' messianic entry into Jerusalem. That's when he's riding on the little donkey, and that's verses 1 to 11 in chapter 11. Now, the next day after that he enters Jerusalem on this donkey begins very early. They're walking from Bethany to Jerusalem, and Jesus finds a fig tree. It says that he was hungry, and he finds a fig tree, but he doesn't find any figs, and so he curses this fig tree. That's verses 12 to 14 there in chapter 11. So Jesus and the disciples from the fig tree, they proceed on into Jerusalem, and they go into the temple where Jesus, for actually the second time in his ministry, cleanses the temple. He drives out the money changers. He drives out those, the sellers that are there. He turns over their tables, all those things, and refers to the fact that they had made the temple a den of thieves. That's verses 15 to 19. All right, so then the next morning, this is the next morning after that, they're on their way again from Bethany to Jerusalem. And so they pass by this fig tree that Jesus had cursed, and they find it withered up and dead. And that's verses 20 to 26 in chapter number 11. And now you want to make a note of that in your mind. This is early morning. They're coming back. This is the entry on one day, cleansing the temple the next day. Now this is this third day, and he's on his way to Jerusalem. And all the events that happen from this point to the end of chapter 13 take place in this day. So this is a very long day, so to speak. They proceed from the fig tree that is withered up and died to Jerusalem, and they enter the temple complex, and when they get there, the chief priests and the scribes and the elders come and challenge. They confront Jesus publicly, and they challenge his authority, questioning him. By what authority are you doing these things? Obviously, one of those things being the driving out of the money changers and sellers from the temple the day before, and the turning over the tables and such as that. That's verses 27 to 33. And Jesus tells the crowd at the temple, including the leaders, he tells them a parable about wicked tenant farmers who kill the owner of the vineyard's son, and they seek to usurp the vineyard for themselves. That's chapter 12, verses 1 to 12. And the Jewish leaders, Mark makes note, they know that this parable is a condemnation of them. They know that. But they are afraid of the crowd to act on it. And so you get littered throughout this day, you get these little references to how they were seeking how they might destroy Jesus, but they were afraid of the crowd because he was being heard gladly, as Mark makes note of. Next, a group of Pharisees and Herodians are sent to confront Jesus and to try to trap him with a question about paying Roman taxes. Now that's verses 13 to 17 in chapter 12. After that, there are some Sadducees that come, and they try to trap him with a question about the resurrection. And that's the famous question of the woman that had married and then married the brother and, you know, went through seven brothers and what have you. That's in verses 18 to 27. Now, there were some of the Pharisees that are listening to this confrontation with the Sadducees. And, of course, the resurrection was one of the points of disagreement and bitter debate between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So some of the Pharisees listened to Jesus essentially destroying his Sadducee opponents with some joy. They were glad about it. And Mark mentions how that one in particular asked Jesus about what was the greatest commandment of the law, and then even commended Jesus' answer of that question. That's verses 28 to 34 in chapter 12. So at this point, Jesus has defeated all of the challengers that have come to him. And Mark makes note of how no one after that would ask him anything. No one else was going to come forward and challenge or ask or try to engage Jesus in any way. And so instead, Jesus puts a question out to this multitude, including the various priests and elders and scribes and Pharisees and so on. Jesus asks them a question about the identity of the Messiah. And it's a question that directly contradicts and corrects the teaching of the scribes. And Jesus' question silences the leaders, but Mark makes a note that the people heard him very gladly. That's verses 35 to 37. So then in verses 38 to 40, which is the beginning of the passage we're looking at, Jesus publicly denounces the scribes and the Pharisees. Now, Mark gives an abbreviated account of this, but when you harmonize it with Matthew and Luke, it shows that his denunciation of the Pharisees was full and it was sharp. That's verses 38 to 40. Jesus moves from there to the treasury, which is the place at the court of women there at the temple. And he makes some remarks about the contributors to the maintenance of the temple and to the religious system of Second Temple Judaism. That's verses 41 to 44, the end of chapter 12. So this is the end of that day. And that evening, he leaves the temple. So all this started that morning when they passed that fig tree that was withered up and dead. All these things happen in this day. I think 9 different episodes that Mark gives us that happen on this day. And then they leave the temple and go east to the Mount of Olives, where Jesus will spend the night with his disciples. And while he's on the Mount of Olives, he teaches them about the destruction of this temple that is coming, and in fact, further future events. That's all of chapter 13, sometimes what is referred to as the Olivet Discourse. Now that ends the first part of this section, or first half of this section at the end of Mark's Gospel. So part of chapter 11 then, and all of chapter 12, cover these 9 episodes that happen in one day's time at the temple. So verses 38 to 44, the passage that we are looking at this evening, these last 2 instances come at the end of this long day where Jesus has repeatedly been challenged and confronted, and he has given some public teaching, which he has not been doing much of at all to this point. And this is actually, when you study out the chronology of what all happens, this is actually Jesus' last day at the temple, publicly teaching and going about. He spends the entirety of the day there. And he ends his last day at the temple with a severe denunciation of the scribes and the Pharisees. So this comes after 3 straight days of the scribes and the Pharisees and the priests, the elders, the Sadducees, and the Herodians. 3 straight days of Jesus doing and saying things that just enrages them and them trying to figure out how to kill him. Now, their tactic on this day was to confront Jesus publicly and to try to trap him into incriminating himself in one way or another, so that they would be justified in charging him and condemning him and getting the Romans to execute him. So everything Jesus did and said was openly opposing the leaders of the Jews, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Herodians, all these various groups that we've talked about. He is opposing them as so if we look at these events, he received praise as the son of David on his entry into Jerusalem. He drove out the money changers and the sellers in the temple. And even when he speaks this parable comes well after the bulk of his teaching in parables. And even though it was a parable, the meaning was clear enough to the Jewish leaders. In other words, everything Jesus does and says during this time is obviously aimed at the leaders of the Jews, and particularly those there at the temple. So Jesus publicly denounces them, and then he observes the treasury, and he gives his disciples some private comments before leaving the temple on this day. So we want to look at this passage. We'll take it in its 2 natural parts, verses 38 to 40, where Jesus denounces the hypocritical leaders, and in verses 41 to 44, where he observes the support for the system that these leaders are perpetuating. Verses 38 to 40. So here is where Jesus denounces the hypocritical leaders. Verse 38. And he said unto them in his doctrine, "Beware of the scribes, which love to go in long clothing, and love salutations in the marketplaces." So this passage now, beginning here with verse 38, this is the last public teaching on this day at the temple. His remarks at the end of this chapter are said to the disciples privately. So this is the last public statement that Jesus makes on this day. The them that Mark refers to is the common people that he referred to back in verse 37. Matthew and Luke both clarify that in this instance, Jesus was talking to the multitude, or he was talking to all of the people there at the temple that were listening to him and listening to him gladly. So that is in Matthew 23 and verse 1 and Luke 20 verses 45 to 47. He uses this word beware, and it's a word of warning, obviously. It's a word that means to look to or to take heed. In other words, it's a command to look and see with your own eyes. It's the way that the word was used. And he denounces the scribes and the Pharisees, as Matthew adds in Matthew 23:2. The scribes and the Pharisees were the primary teachers. They were the primary leaders, the religious leaders of the people of Israel. The Sadducees, for the most part, they had control of the high priesthood. They were a dominant presence on the council of the Sanhedrin. And they did not really have as mix as much with the common people of Israel. And they weren't generally highly esteemed among the common people. But with the scribes and Pharisees, that was a different story. They were the teachers. They were viewed as the experts of the law. They were the ones that would be deliberating in the various matters and directing the people on all matters of religion and life and faith and practice and so on. Mark and Luke both give an abbreviated account of this speech. So verses 38 to 40 is a very abbreviated account. But Matthew actually gives a much fuller account. In fact, when you look at it, it's Matthew 23. And his denunciation of the Pharisees, scribes and Pharisees, actually accounts for 38 verses in Matthew 23. Now, Mark and Luke are nearly identical in what they report. And also what follows is identical in Luke as it is in Mark. So in this denunciation of the scribes and Pharisees, Mark has selected five different instances. So there are five practices of the Pharisees that he emphasizes. Again, Luke uses those same five. Four of these practices that are denounced are things that the Pharisees did specifically to be seen. They did them for a show, so that they would be seen doing these things, and that they would be revered by the common people, and that they would have a certain reputation. And one of these practices that is mentioned particularly shows their hypocrisy in their practices. And again, Luke is basically identical with Mark in this. So both Mark and Luke have taken from a much longer list in Matthew 23. In Matthew 23, Jesus denounces many, many teachings and practices of the scribes and Pharisees. But Marcus has selected out five in particular. Obviously five, as you read it, that fits very well as he has put this account together. What does he say about them? Well, he says they love to go in long clothing. They love, and that word means that they prefer. That is their choice. That's what they desire, what they want to do. They go about in long clothing or talking about long robes. And these would be very ornate. These would be robes that would be easily identifiable. They would be identified as holy men in Israel, as leaders and teachers of the Jews and so on. But both Mark and Luke talk about how they loved to go about that way. So they loved to put on the long robes and to go about publicly so that they could be seen and recognized as these leaders. In other words, it was for a show. They loved to go about and to be seen that way. He goes on to say in verse 38 that they love salutations in the marketplace. They loved being greeted by the people. Now, this was not just regular, ordinary, run-of-the-mill greetings. And in fact, when you read some of the Jewish literature of the day, they would be called things like master and teacher and rabbi, and sometimes terms like exalted would be joined to these, and they would even sometimes be addressed as father or as fathers. And of course, Jesus spoke against this directly when he said to call no man father, but your father in heaven. And then in verse 39, and the chief seats in the synagogues and the uppermost rooms at the feast. So he's continuing here of the things that the scribes and Pharisees love. Now, synagogue gatherings and banquets in that day had seating arrangement that ordered people according to rank or importance. This is something actually that even though it was a synagogue, even though it was a Jewish banquet that might be held, this is something that actually had come under influence from the Hellenistic society. So the Greco-Roman culture, and I read a pretty lengthy book on the history of Greco-Roman banquets, and it was very, very fascinating and all of that. But one of the things that was a mainstay feature of those banquets was that all classes would have to be observed. There was a distinction. Your rank and your place in society relative to the other people at the banquet would be distinguished by the place where you were sitting. And you did not violate those, or you would be moved to another place, or even just removed from the banquet at all. And so from what I've understood in that, by that first century time, this is actually something that had gained as a part of the practice of the Jewish banquets and even of their synagogues, that they were observing this strict seating that was a class seating. So you would have those that would be of authority and of power and of high standing, people that were wealthy and you know, all the way down until you got to the poorest of the poor. And they would always be separated and would be distinguished by where they sat. So the scribes and the Pharisees were those that when they went to the synagogue or when they went to these Jewish banquets, they were given high places. They were given seats of honor. And Jesus is saying they love it. They love to be seated in these places of importance and places of notoriety. And generally, the seating would be arranged as such that these prominent positions would be obvious. They would be clearly seen and viewable by others that were attending. So it was well known who was the highest of rank, the highest of importance at this particular event, just simply by where they were sitting. And the Pharisees loved that. Verse 40, which devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers, these shall receive greater damnation. So Mark adds here in verse 40 a particular practice or a reference to practices that illustrates the hypocrisy of all their religious pretense. They devour widows' houses, all the while that they're going about in long robes, being called exalted rabbi and exalted father and things like that by the people, being ushered to the highest and most important seats at the events. All the while that they're doing these things, he talks about making long prayers. We'll just talk about that in a moment. All the while they're devouring. And that word devouring, it means to consume by eating, but it was used figuratively to speak of stripping one of their property, whether that would be through craft or whether that would be by force. So the scribes, for instance, there's a few different ways in which they were devouring widows' houses. The scribes were not just copyists of the law. They also had other duties to perform. And those duties would include the drafting and filing of legal documents. So when the people of Israel, whether it would be a sale of land, whether it would be genealogical records, whether it would be a bill of divorcement, whether it would be a will, or something of that nature. Obviously, among the people of Israel, the genealogies were extremely important. The laws of inheritance and property ownership and all of that sort of thing. They were very scrupulous in trying to keep track of those things. So the scribes were also involved in that legal process, not just in making copies of the law. And historically, it is reported that they would perform such services, particularly for widows, and essentially would take advantage of them by extorting them. They would charge them exorbitant fees for these kind of services. They, just as they took advantage of the poor in their whole system of sacrifices for the poor. So the poor would have to purchase these animals, or the money out of the temple collection that was taken for that purpose would be used. So they were really, when you look at it, they were double dipping in that as well. They were paying exorbitant prices for these animals to be sacrificed. Well, widows were obviously among the poor in that regard that were being taken advantage of there also. Sometimes I've read accounts of how that the Pharisees and the scribes would act as estate managers for widows. And in addition to their fees for what they were doing, that generally the widow's property would be claimed upon her death as a full payment for their services. Pharisees would take advantage of widows by living in their houses and requiring their support as the widow's duty to God. You know, you have to support me and so on. The teaching of Corban would divert support that should come to them from their children, and it would divert it to the temple and ultimately to the leaders' pockets. They had established a system that taught in various ways that giving, the giving of alms and so on, was the path to God's blessings. And their teaching even sounded as though giving could be redemptive, therefore leading to eternal life. So they did all this, and they thought themselves to be righteous according to the law, even though the law emphasized special care for widows, commanded special consideration, and had certain built-in protections for them because they were easily oppressed and easily taken advantage of. Further, the prophets, when you read the books of the prophets, they're just littered with judgments against Israel and Judah, and oftentimes oppression of widows is one of those things that is mentioned in among their many sins. Well, Luke said very plainly that the Pharisees were covetous. They were greedy. They were lovers of money. Luke chapter 16 and verse number 14. And all the while, Mark adds at the end, in Jesus' words, they, for a pretense, make long prayers. So all the while, they made long prayers publicly so that they could be seen and could be revered by people as being devoted and pious. Well, a pretense is obviously an outward show, and it speaks of their hypocrisy, showing that their motive was not one of sincerity, though they had convinced many that they were sincere. And Jesus says they'll receive a greater damnation. Well, a greater damnation was pronounced because they were teachers and leaders of the people. These were the shepherds of Israel at this time. And they will receive a greater damnation because they have corrupted God's word and essentially used it to abuse people and to enrich themselves. So let me come to the second part, and that's verses 41 to 44. Where Jesus, after denouncing the scribes and Pharisees, he goes to the treasury and observes the support for all of this system that he has denounced. Verse 41. And Jesus sat over against the treasury and beheld how the people cast money into the treasury, and many that were rich cast in much. So Jesus moves over to this place known as the Court of Women, where there were these offering chests. These chests were some sort of trumpet-shaped receptacles, and there were 13 of them, and each one was for a different purpose. And now these purposes were not, these offerings and these receptacles were not for the giving of alms for the general provision of the poor. That's not what these were for. They were for the support of the temple and various services. So they were in a support of the facility. So one of them would be dedicated, reserved for giving in order for the purchase of gold for the temple and that sort of thing, wood for fires and sacrifices. I believe there was one that I've read that was for the sacrifices for the poor. So for those that truly could not afford to purchase or provide an animal for themselves, this offering would be used, and again, at an exorbitant rate. So there was just, you know, another instance of double dipping. So these were for the support of the temple and for the services of the temple. These were not things that actually, these offerings that were given here did not go to actually help the poor. Like, it wasn't money goes in one and so a poor person is fed. It wasn't that sort of thing at all. Now, some would maybe cast only into one. They would give toward a particular purpose. Some, no doubt, would cast into maybe a few of them. And some of them, no doubt, would put something into each one of them, and so on. And so Mark notes that Jesus went to this treasury, this place of this of these offering receptacles, and Jesus was watching them as they were giving in to these various places. And he noted that there were some persons, some rich persons, that cast in much. And that simply indicates that it was a large or an abundant contribution. It's a large sum of money that they were putting in. Verse 42. And there came a certain poor widow, and she threw in two mites, which make a farthing. So Jesus also observes this approach of this widow. Mark makes a note of the fact that she was a poor widow, not just a widow, but a poor widow. And the word that is used is actually the word that means a pauper or a beggar. In other words, this was a destitute woman. Her husband had died. Now, either she had no family or children to help provide for her, or if she did have them, they were not supporting her, it doesn't seem. She was a destitute, impoverished widow. She put two mites into the receptacle. A mite, as I understand it, was the smallest coin in worth that was in circulation in that day. In other words, there was no lesser amount of money than a mite. It's the smallest coin. Now, I read several different attempts at calculations, and you had money that the Jews used, and you had Greek money, and you had Roman money, and you had, it's one of the reasons why you had exchangers, as you had Jews traveling in from all of these different places in the Roman Empire, and they would be exchanging money for the money for the temple, the Jews' money, and so on. So I've read various calculations of trying to put an exact worth. Here's one thing that is certain, right? So the Bible tells us that a penny was a day's wage. That was equivalent to the denarius or some other coins. But a penny was a day's wage. So if a penny was a day's wage, a mite was less than a penny, and a mite was actually only a small fraction of a penny. So I've seen a few different values put for that, which are different. So I don't know exactly, but we do know that It was a very small amount. It was a very small fraction of a day's wage. And a day's wage would be that for a common day laborer. Now, some Jewish historians have noted that this was actually the least amount that could be put into the offering. Verse 43. And she called unto him, and he called unto him his disciples, and saith unto them, Verily I say unto you, that this poor widow hath cast more in than all they which have cast into the treasury. So after this, Jesus calls his disciples to him. Now that signals that he gathered them to himself in order to instruct them privately. Again, at this point, he's no longer talking to the crowd or to the general population of people that are around him. He's speaking now to his disciples. And he begins his statement to them with, Verily I say unto you, verily or truly. And this is an indication that what he's about to say is true, obviously, but not only that, but that it is counterintuitive. At least what Jesus is about to tell them is truth, and it is against the grain of common opinion or common perception of things. So Jesus is about to essentially interpret this scene before them. He states that the widow has put in more than all of the rich have. Now, Mark noted that they were putting in large amounts. He said that at the very beginning. So they're putting in large amounts of money into the treasury receptacles. But Jesus simply observes his disciples that she had actually put in a greater amount. Verse 44. For all they did cast in of their abundance, but she of her want did cast in all that she had, even all her living. So the rich had put in large sums, but it was out of their abundance, Jesus says. In other words, they gave big, they did, but it wasn't in any way a sacrifice to them. They were not in any way left doing without, even despite the fact that they put in large amounts. But the widow, Jesus says, gave everything that she had. And Jesus meant this literally. I mean, as he explains this, he meant this literally. She has given everything that she had. He follows it essentially by saying, she's given everything that she had to live on, even all her living. Now, the word for want, Jesus says that she gave out of her want. And that word, it means poverty. It means being without. She was in a state of being without. And still yet, she gave everything that she did have into this treasury. All her living meant that she had nothing to buy food, to buy anything else that she needed, until she could either beg for more, receive some sort of charity, or perhaps maybe earn a little bit more in some way of working. All right, so this is the account at the end of this day. What is the point of this account? What is it that Jesus is teaching his disciples? Well, it's quite popular to hold this woman as the example of what we ought to emulate. And if that being the case, then Jesus would be telling his disciples, you need to be like her. And it's easy to come to this conclusion if we ignore the context and we come to this passage with a sort of rich equals bad, poor equals good kind of classist mindset. But first, I just want to draw your attention to some things that are not there. Things the text does not say. The text does not say that this widow was a believer. It doesn't say that she was giving out of faith and out of devotion to God with a complete trust in Him to supply all her needs. I've read some commentators that said that. Oh, she gave in everything she had. She was devoted to God and she wanted to serve Him with everything she had. And she gave out of complete trust in Him that He would supply all her needs. It's just not in the text. It doesn't tell us that. The text also does not condemn the rich that gave large amounts out of their abundance. It doesn't say anything negative about them. It's simply an observation that even though they gave large amounts, they gave it out of the abundance of what they had, so it didn't, in any way, it didn't hurt them to give it. It didn't leave them in any way without. And yet this woman gave all that she had, and it left her without. So she gave more. So Jesus merely presents what happened, and he gives clarification of what they had seen. Well, so where does the context put us with this account? Well, this was coming at the end of a long day at the temple where Jesus had repeatedly enraged the priests and the elders and the scribes and the Pharisees and the Herodians. His public teaching that was given on this day was a scathing rebuke of those leaders and a pronouncement of judgment on them. And that night, they left directly from the treasury and proceeded to the Mount of Olives. And that very night, Jesus told the disciples how that this temple would be obliterated, meaning that the destruction of this temple was God's judgment against that whole entire religious system. It was being done away with. So in that context, was Jesus telling them to be like this poor widow who was more wholly devoted to this religious system by giving all that she had than all of the rich that put in their large sums? That wouldn't seem to make any sense. Ending his day at the temple, she was a living illustration, and she was a confirmation of his denouncing of the scribes and Pharisees. Jesus is not being harsh to her. He's just accurately telling the facts. I believe ultimately Jesus is pitying her. She's a living illustration of a victim of this system. She was an impoverished widow who was being devoured by the scribes and the Pharisees as she dutifully contributed even the last bit that she had to seek the blessings that their teachings had promised her. So here's a woman who goes away from the temple without anything to buy food or to buy anything that she needs. She's given the last of what she's got so that a little bit more gold can be put on the temple. As I understand it, at this time, the entire eastern face of this temple complex was entirely plated in gold. A little more gold for the temple. Maybe a little more wood for the fire. And again, a lot of this money had its ways into the pockets of the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees and so on. So is Jesus telling them to be like her? Well, what is the point? Well, the point is plainly stated in verse number 38. Beware of false teachers and false religion. That is the point. Jesus is ending his day saying, beware of those who would bind you with requirements that God never made, those who are hypocritical in their pretenses, those who grow fat off of their followers, which is again something that the priests and false prophets and many of those in Israel were continually condemned for by the prophets. Well, these things are not the way to God. These things are not the way to God's blessings and to eternal life. Rather, it is through faith in God's Son, who was crucified as a sacrifice for sins and saves by His grace, apart from any and all works of the law, including monetary gifts. This is the God who spoke through the prophet Isaiah in Isaiah 55, verses 1 to 3, and said, "Ho, everyone that thirsteth, come ye to the waters, and he that hath no money, come ye, buy and eat. Yea, come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. Wherefore do ye spend money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which satisfieth not? Hearken diligently unto me, and eat ye that which is good. And let your soul delight itself in fatness. Incline your ear, and come unto me. Hear, and your soul shall live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you. Even the sure mercies of David. Paul, in Romans chapter 3, verses 23 and 26, wrote, "For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, being justified freely by His grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God hath set forth to be a propitiation through faith in His blood, to declare His righteousness for the remission of sins that are past, through the forbearance of God, to declare, I say at this time, His righteousness, that He might be just and the justifier of him which believeth in Jesus." Now, Jesus' message was to forsake all and follow Him, which included the false teaching and traditions and system of the scribes and the Pharisees.